Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
Evening-ish, ladies and gentlemen. The ship has reached the shore.
Nearly 200 countries have agreed to protect biodiversity in the world's oceans after a decade of negotiations. We'll look at the historic UN High Seas Treaty. Then, Tennessee bans gender-affirming health care for minors, becoming the latest state to target the trans community. We'll speak with Chase Strangio of the ACLU.
In 2023, already over 400 bills have been introduced in states across the country targeting LGBTQ people, the majority of these bills targeting trans people. It's just the beginning of March, and four states have already banned healthcare for trans adolescents, and we're seeing these bills escalate with efforts to ban care for adults, as well as efforts to criminalize trans people using the restroom.
Plus, brand threat. That's what Fox executives called Fox reporters and anchors questioning Trump's false election claims. We'll speak with the president of Media Matters. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At the United Nations, negotiators from more than 190 countries have agreed to the first-ever international treaty to protect the high seas. The historic agreement caps nearly 20 years of efforts by conservation groups. It seeks to establish marine protected areas covering 30% of the world's seas by 2030 to protect ocean biodiversity. Environmentalists hail the treaty's passage as a major milestone, calling on nations to swiftly adopt and ratify it. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature said in a statement the treaty, quote, closes essential gaps in international law and offers a framework for governments to work together to protect global ocean health, climate resilience, and the socioeconomic well-being and food security of billions of people, unquote. We'll have more on the High Seas Treaty after headlines. The International Atomic Energy Agency and Iran have agreed to increase cooperation and monitoring of nuclear activities following a visit by IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi to Tehran.
We have agreed is on a number of concrete actions like accesses that we are going to have to information and places. I believe that an improvement, a marked improvement, at least in terms of my dialogue with the Iranian government, has been registered.
The agreement offered a glimmer of hope following recent reports Iran successfully enriched uranium to near weapons-grade level and amid stalled talks on reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which the U.S. withdrew from in 2018 under President Trump. In Iran, worried parents protested in the streets of Tehran and other cities Saturday following a spate of apparent poisonings at dozens of girls' schools since November. Last week, authorities said they would investigate the attacks, which have affected hundreds of students as well as teachers and staff. Human Rights Watch warned authorities, quote, long history of disregard for the basic rights of Iranian citizens, especially women and girls, leaves little reason to be hopeful, unquote. This is a teacher at one of the targeted schools describing the experience.
The students all felt the same symptoms as me. They had coughs. Some of them said their eyes burned, and most of them were scared.
New report by the UN Special Rapporteur on Afghanistan warns the Taliban has normalized systemic violence and human rights abuses against women and girls and says it may amount to gender persecution, a crime against humanity. The report condemns cases of arbitrary arrests of women protesters, as well as bans on women and girls from schools, most jobs, and even their use of public parks. The report also finds journalists and dissidents are subjected to surveillance, harassment, violence, and detention. Economic sanctions on the Taliban and the loss of foreign aid have also exacerbated humanitarian concerns in Afghanistan, as an estimated almost 19 million Afghans, or half the population, are experiencing hunger. In Pakistan, former Prime Minister Imran Khan evaded arrest Sunday as police showed up at his home in Lahore, where hundreds of his supporters protested outside. Khan is accused of corruption and terrorism charges he denies. He's been demanding a snap election since his ouster in a parliamentary vote early last year. Pakistan's media regulator has banned the broadcasting of speeches and news conferences by Imran Khan. In Bangladesh, a massive fire at a refugee camp in Cox's Bazar has left at least 12,000 Rohingya Muslims without shelter. Some 2,000 housing structures, as well as health clinics, learning centers, water distributing facilities, and over two dozen mosques were destroyed by the blaze. Many refugees returned to the site today to try to salvage some of their belongings from the burnt rubble. Authorities say one person has been detained in connection with the fire, which is still under investigation. Cox's Bazar houses over a million Rohingya Muslims forced to flee violent persecution in Burma beginning in 2017. In Nigeria, an explosion at a Shell oil pipeline killed at least 12 people Friday in the Southern Rivers State. The blast came during a theft of crude oil, a booming illicit industry in Nigeria. In related news, over 13,000 residents of the oil-rich Niger Delta joined a landmark British lawsuit against Shell and its Nigerian subsidiary earlier this year. The lawsuit's demanding compensation and cleanup for dozens of oil spills that have devastated land and waterways, destroying local livelihoods and ecosystems. To see Democracy Now!'s documentary, Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship, go to democracynow.org. The UK will start removing asylum seekers who arrive on small boats through the English Channel, barring anyone who lands on British soil through non-official ports of entry. Under the new rules, the removed individuals would also be barred from returning to the UK. The Conservative British government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has vowed to stop the boats as one of its main priorities. Elsewhere in Europe, the Italian Coast Guard rescued over 200 migrants off the coast of Lampedusa on Friday, as the far-right government of Giorgia Meloni has also imposed draconian anti-refugee policies. Meanwhile, one of the victims of last month's tragic shipwreck off the Calabrian coast has been identified as Shahida Raza, who played on Pakistan's national soccer and field hockey teams. Raza, who is a member of the Shiite Muslim Hazara minority, had fled towards Europe in hopes for providing a better life for her disabled 3-year-old son. In Greece, fresh protests rocked the streets of Athens Sunday as anger mounts over last week's train crash that killed 57 people. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis apologized for the disaster Sunday, saying in a statement, quote, "We cannot, will not, and must not hide behind human error," he said. The station master at Larissa Railway Station has been detained and awaits trial. Among the 10,000 estimated protesters yesterday were many rail workers.
We feel unspeakable grief over the incident. It is tragic. We cannot soothe the pain of the families who lost their kids, nor can we bring them back. But we are here so that nothing remains in darkness, for everything to be revealed to the bone, for those responsible to pay, those who have left the railway to its fate, all the governments, all these years.
Here in the United States, Norfolk Southern CEO Alan Shaw will testify before a Senate panel Thursday about last month's train derailment and contamination of East Palestine, Ohio. This comes as another Norfolk Southern train derailed near Springfield, Ohio, Saturday, prompting officials to issue a temporary shelter-in-place order. Officials said none of the 28 train cars involved in the crash itself contained hazardous materials, though other sections of the 212-car train did contain dangerous chemicals, including propane. President Biden was in Selma, Alabama, Sunday to mark the 58th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, when state troopers violently attacked black voting rights activists as they attempted to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Biden sought to refocus attention on voting rights legislation, which has stalled in Congress, as he's expected to soon announce his bid for re-election.
The right to vote, the right to vote, to have your vote counted, is the threshold of democracy and liberty. With it, anything's possible. Without it, without that right, nothing is possible. And this fundamental right remains under assault.
In Maryland, former President Trump was met with thunderous applause at this year's Conservative Political Action Conference, where he delivered the keynote speech Saturday. Trump, who was introduced as the next president of the United States, gave a nearly two-hour address in which he railed against the investigations he's under and lied about winning the 2020 election.
In 2016, I declared, I am your voice. Today, I add, I am your warrior. I am your justice. And for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution.
Trump's likely competitor, right-wing Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, addressed supporters at a rally in Southern California Sunday, where he repeated his motto, Florida is where woke goes to die. Meanwhile, self-help author Marianne Williamson launched her bid for the Democratic nomination for president this weekend.
It is our job to create a vision of justice and love that is so powerful that it will override the forces of hatred and injustice and fear.
Williamson, who also ran in 2020, said some of her key campaign promises were free health care, free college, and free child care. In Atlanta, Georgia, at least 35 people were arrested Sunday as protesters marked the start of a nationwide week of action against Cop City, a $90 million police training facility being built in the Uilani Forest. The Defend the Atlanta Forest Collective said those arrested were peaceful protesters who were attending a concert in the forest when they were surrounded by police. This comes less than 2 months after Atlanta police shot and killed Manuel Perez Terán, a 26-year-old environmental defender who also went by the name Tortuguita. At least 13 people have died across the United States in recent days from a mix of extreme weather events, including tornadoes, torrential rains, and flooding across southern states, and historic snowfall on the West Coast. California officials say the unusually wet winter has helped ease some of the state's decade-long drought, though scientists say it would take several consecutive winters, like 2023's, to fully alleviate the statewide drought. Nearly two dozen lawmakers are calling on President Biden to reject a massive oil and gas development in northern Alaska known as the Willow Project. The project was initially approved by President Trump in 2020 and would have allowed ConocoPhillips to extract over 100,000 barrels of oil a day for the next 30 years. The project was halted by a federal judge in 2021 after environmental and indigenous groups sued. Since then, the Biden administration has been considering a scaled-down plan, and a final decision is expected within days. In a letter sent to President Biden Friday, 22 members of the House and Senate wrote, no version of the Willow Master Development Plan is consistent with your commitments to combat the climate crisis and promote environmental justice, unquote. And the trailblazing civil rights activist Judy Heumann died Saturday at the age of 75. She was widely known as the mother of the U.S. disability rights movement for breaking down barriers faced by disabled people and leading campaigns for historic legislation, including the Americans with Disabilities Act. In 1970, Heumann became the first teacher in New York to use a wheelchair. In 1977, she led a 26-day sit-in protest at a federal building in San Francisco that led to enforcement of the Rehabilitation Act's prohibition on discrimination against disabled people. President Biden honored Judy Heumann in a statement writing, quote, after her school principal said she couldn't enter kindergarten because she was using a wheelchair, Judy dedicated the rest of her life to fighting for the inherent dignity of people with disabilities, Biden said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at how nearly 200 countries have agreed to protect biodiversity in the world's oceans. The historic United Nations High Seas Treaty is a legally binding pact that could help reverse marine biodiversity loss by addressing pollution, acidification, and overfishing. It was agreed to at a United Nations conference Saturday.
Good evening-ish, ladies and gentlemen. The ship has reached the shore.
The historic agreement caps nearly two decades of efforts by conservation groups and seeks to establish marine protected areas covering 30% of the world's seas by 2030 to protect ocean biodiversity. Environmentalists hail the treaty's passage as a major milestone. Greenpeace's ocean campaigner Laura Meller called for the treaty to be ratified as quickly as possible to, quote, deliver the fully protected ocean sanctuaries our planet needs, she said. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature said its adoption, quote, closes essential gaps in international law and offers a framework for governments to work together to protect global ocean health, climate resilience, and the socioeconomic well-being and food security of billions of people. For more, we're joined by Minna Epps, a marine biologist and director of the ocean team at the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. She participated in the UN negotiations on the High Seas Treaty. She's joining us now from Geneva, Switzerland. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Minna Epps. Talk about the significance of this long-negotiated treaty, what it does accomplish and what it doesn't.
So, hi. Yes, good morning to you all, and I'm very pleased to be here. It is indeed a historical milestone, and it's certainly good news for all our ocean defenders out there. So, I think it's been long overdue, as you said. So, this treaty has been negotiated for the past 5 years, but as you said, been in discussion for a very long time. And I think that our climate, our world, has changed quite a lot since. In terms of the importance of the ocean and its benefits and services has really increased on the public, but also political agenda. So I think that the momentum was really right. And if we wouldn't have agreed now, then it would have been, a part failure to kind of protect our ocean, which is so vital to us. So we are increasingly understanding the importance of the ocean in terms of climate change adaptation and mitigation, but also to protect biodiversity. And you alluded to the milestone commitment that was made by all states in Kunming Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework adopted in December, which really sets out to protect 30%, not just of land and coastal areas, but of the ocean. And in order to achieve that, you know, we cannot ignore two-thirds of the ocean, which is the high seas, the areas beyond national jurisdiction. So, you mentioned that, you know, we're able to establish marine protected area. So today there hasn't been, you know, any kind of mechanism to establish or a legal framework to establish marine protected areas in the high seas. But this treaty actually sets out to do much more than that. It's really in general to, you know, to conserve and sustainable use of marine biological diversity beyond national jurisdiction. So it really has been a package deal. It's been a long road, and I have to still compliment all the negotiators, especially the last 40-hour marathon that they went through in order to reach an agreement, which, as we know, multilateralism is being challenged at the moment. And the fact that they were able to reach an agreement, I think, was just so welcome. And it was incredible. So in terms of what this treaty can do or offer, it's basically a legal, internationally legally binding treaty under the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea, which was established about 40 years ago. So this is really kind of looking to actively, you know, conserve and ensure sustainable use. So it's about not just about establishing marine protected areas, but also to make sure that, you know, the ocean as a whole is and human activity is managed. So we know what we need to do to protect or restore ocean health. We need to remove the threats, enhance recovery, and build resilience. And of course, one of the best ways to do that is really to invest in establishing a network of marine protected areas that can serve those multiple benefits. But it's also about being able to conduct environmental impact assessments to ensure that, you know, any activity, human activity, does not negatively harm the marine environment. But also the other part of the package relates to access and benefit sharing of marine genetic resources, as well as the capacity building needed for marine technology, transfer of marine technology. So that's kind of essential then. But of course, there's a lot of cross-cutting issues that needs to be resolved, whether in terms of dispute settlement, the financial mechanism, et cetera, et cetera. So we are really hopeful. The text just came out a few hours ago, so we will see what the final details are. But whatever it is, it's welcome, and we will have to work with that.
I wanted to turn to comments from one of the Russian delegates at the conference who criticized the negotiating process.
Given the limited time available, it is impossible to properly review the draft we have just received. Large parts of these texts are very much new to our delegation and represent parts of deals in which our delegation did not have a chance to participate. We are not prepared to limit our further engagement to technical amendments and reserve our position broadly in this regard.
And this is a member of the Nicaraguan delegation.
Indeed, yes. The sound.
Sorry, we're going to play the member Quality. Of the. We're going to play a member of the Nicaraguan delegation also criticizing the negotiations.
Furthermore, we want to express our concern regarding the method of work employed that did not guarantee the equality, equity, the balance, and transparency during this process, with multiple parallel meetings making it difficult for small delegations to participate, thus excluding some developing countries.
Mina Epps, if you could respond.
Okay, in terms of not having enough time, of course, time was not on their side. But I think that a lot of, I think the president handled it quite well. She was very conscious of being inclusive and listened to various parts. And I believe that some of these issues that were brought up by the Russian delegation or introduced new proposal, the president did remind that a lot of this text have been, the paragraphs have virtually essentially stayed the same in the last few rounds of negotiations. So it wasn't new text per se, and it was basically very late hour to introduce new proposals, which a few countries did rather towards the end. And these were typically countries that have been quite quiet in the previous round. And as we were getting closer to seal a deal, if you like, basically spoke up more vocally and was trying to introduce new language, which was basically too late in the day. There was some time stalling activities or basically taking the floor, and the president really wanted to move this forward. But I think everybody worked on the same premises in terms of having to review the text quite rapidly. I mean, at that stage, they had seen all the texts and they were still some changes, but they have been very familiar with the text. So I think that time was short for all the delegates, but they managed to come through. I would say that in terms of the Nicaraguan comments on basically being unfair. I think that there were several, particularly the small island development states, that yes, they have smaller delegation. And I think that, you know, dividing it up to small groups, of course, it is a stretch if you have a smaller delegation. But I think that they were really trying to work constructively, having bilaterals, et cetera, so that, you know, it could be accommodated.
I wanted to go to some of the key points, like the agreement to share marine genetic resources. What does that mean?
Yes, it basically means that, you know, both now or also looking at the future, there might be potential new discoveries, as you wish, in terms of mineral, and they could be monetary and non-benefit sharing. But it's basically how can you get access to these and also sharing the benefits, given that the high seas is a common heritage of humankind. So it kind of belongs to all of us. So there was a lot of discussion and sticking points in terms of, you know, percentage or royalties and benefit sharing. And it really came down to, you know, equity, principles of equity. And I think that was, you know, the major sticking points of the negotiation towards the end was really, you know, what in terms of the global north and the global south divide in terms of equality and, you know, fair and equitable access and benefit sharing.
And requiring environmental checks on deep sea mining.
Yeah, so in terms with the seabed floor, it's actually managed by a different authority called the International Seabed Authority, which actually has a mandate to protect but also explore the deep sea. And there are now several, more than 30 exploration licenses pending that have been approved for exploration. It basically covers an area the size of Mongolia, and that could have very significant adverse environmental damage. So it's also, there was particular language in this treaty that would actually dictate, you know, which presides over Earth. So make sure that you cannot, the International Seabed Authority cannot issue both exploitation licenses if it will hamper marine biodiversity in the high seas. So it's also how these two instrument will actually play out together, because it's currently managed by a different authorization. So I think what we really wanted here is a strong high seas treaty that can actually treat and manage the whole governance of the ocean, as it's the legal framework have been quite fragmented. So the details.
Dr. Epps, wanted to, since we have so little time, for you to talk about why the oceans are so important when it comes to dealing with the climate, covering more than 70% of the Earth's surface, absorbing 90% of the world's excess heat, and also address the amount of plastic in the world's oceans.
Yeah, so the ocean is under a major threat, and I think that we talk about plastic pollutions, et cetera, in the ocean. And a lot of things that happens at the high sea is basically out of sight and out of mind. But what has happened, what you were describing, is that, yes, the ocean have been providing these services as absorbing excessive CO2 emissions. But we don't want the ocean to continue to provide those kind of services. We need to cut emissions rapidly in order because we have tampered so much with the chemistry of the ocean that I don't think that, you know, general public or policymakers really realize the severe threat. And the UN Secretary General of the United Nations declared an ocean emergency last year. So it's absolutely crucial. And we think that protecting nature and the ocean is really our best ally to fight climate change and build that resilience, but also to help enhance recovery. But there is currently under negotiation, which has just started in Uruguay, to have a global plastic treaty, a global treaty on plastic ban, which actually is being negotiated and hopefully can conclude faster than the High Seas Treaty, which will also have a very positive impact on our ocean to restore ocean health.
And what is the implementation of this treaty, and how long did it actually take to negotiate?
For the High Seas Treaty, it started in 2018, but actually before that, you will have preparatory COMS meeting. And I think it was decided in 2015 to go forward and have official rounds of negotiations. And they set out four rounds, 2 weeks each, was the estimated time to conclude. Now, we didn't conclude in the fourth round, which was resumed after the global pandemic. And as we know, it was a pause of more than 2 years, almost 2.5 years. And the political climate had changed significantly and we came back to a different world because we have to have in-person meeting when it comes to kind of international diplomacy. So I think that a lot of governments had changed for the worse, for the better. But I think that was some of the delays that it took time, that it wasn't possible just to come back once and conclude. And we really need to deliver on that promise of multilateralism. So I-